What's up, everyone? This is Jamilia from ByteBow, and you're listening to the Barely Legal in Web3 podcast, the show that talks about Web3 in a way that you can understand and highlights some of the barely legal stuff that's happening in the ever-evolving world of crypto, NFTs, and DAOs. On this show, I give you legal analysis and a bit of perspective, along with my amazing guests who are all thriving in these Web3 streets. So if you're ready, let's take a look at what's been barely legal in Web3. What's up, everyone? Welcome to the next episode of Barely Legal in Web3. I'm your host, Jamilia Greer. Today is a very interesting episode, in my mind, at least I'd like to think so. It is about my journey from in-house counsel to Web3 degen. And of course, I would never refer to myself as a Web3 degen, except for purposes of titling this episode. So let's get into it. I'd like to give a bit of a personal introduction about me. First, for those of you that don't know, I'm an international attorney. My career started out in Connecticut, where I'm originally from, small town Connecticut. And I started out after graduating from University of Connecticut School of Law, working in a regional firm. Shout out to Day Pitney. And worked in that firm for a couple of years. And I had this background of having spent a summer in China before my time at that firm. And I truly loved everything about being in China at the time. I remember my first trip to China, I was about 19 years old. I had gone during my junior year of undergrad, and the job was essentially to teach English. And at the time, I spoke absolutely no Chinese, like zero. But I took the job. I really wanted to go and get the experience under my belt of being in an international setting. So I went out to China, I went to Hangzhou, I taught English there for a summer, I made some great friends. My students were actually only a couple of years younger than me, so it was a very interesting dynamic where I'm up in front of a classroom teaching, and afterwards we would go to the arcade together. It was just a really great, impressionable experience. And I knew from that point on that whatever I wanted to do, it either had to be international or had to involve China. And so far in my career, I have stuck to that. I've stuck to that promise to myself. When I got to law school, I already had this idea in my mind that I wanted to practice some kind of international law. And Connecticut is obviously not the place to practice anything international. Compared to other markets, compared to New York, compared to California, compared to DC, no one is really in Connecticut, at least no one at that time, was in Connecticut thinking, I'm going to have an international practice. So I started my career at Day Pitney. I practiced corporate law, bankruptcy law. I worked for a partner who is currently a bankruptcy judge in Connecticut, James Tancredi, who was a mentor at the time and still is a mentor in my mind, although I haven't been in touch with him for years. And so that experience of working in Connecticut really made it clear to me that whatever it was that I wanted to do or was going to do had to be in the international arena. And I recall in 2008, we had the financial crisis, and I was an associate at the time. And my partner, my law firm partner, who I was working with as a bankruptcy judge, and I said to him, I said, Jim, we probably could build a business off of creditors that are based in China that are looking to claim on their debts in U.S. bankruptcy court. And I created this whole big pitch deck, and I had this whole presentation, which I pitched to the executive committee at the law firm. And this is huge for an associate to be doing something like that. For those of you that are listening that currently work in big law or at a firm, if you're an associate, the idea of pitching to the executive committee filled with partners is like, why would you do that? Why would you want to put yourself on the chopping block? But I did. And they bought it. And we had a business development trip to China. We went out there. We had some targets that we were looking to work with. And it was great. It was a great experience. But at the end of the day, I realized that working in Connecticut just was not going to be my destiny. Because even though the firm wanted to build a China practice or have a China initiative, it just wasn't structured for it. And after working at Day Pitney, I went on to teach in China. I taught international trade law at Dalian, or for those of you that speak Chinese, it's Dongbei Caijing Dashue, which means Dongbei University of Finance and Economics. So I did that for a year, and once again, wonderful experience, but I need to get back to Connecticut. And I remember going back to Connecticut and interviewing for jobs after that role. And I went into United Technologies Corporation, and I was interviewing for a trade compliance manager role, and it required some knowledge of import-export regulations. I didn't really have much background in that at the time. For the U.S. side, my background was more on the structuring of trade deals. And I recall the hiring manager looked at me and he said, I know you came into this office and into this interview thinking that you were interviewing for a job to be based in Connecticut, but we actually want you to be based in Shanghai. And I remember going back home and telling my mom, yeah, I think I got the job. And she was like, yay, that's great. And I'm like, yeah, but it's going to be in Shanghai. And she was quite upset. Because I had been away for a year, so she was really upset about that. I had wanted to build an international career in law, and I wanted to be based outside of the U.S. so I could really get experience working in China, doing business in China, and also building up this skill set of navigating cross-border deals. So I worked with United Technologies for about 7-8 years. I had a variety of roles, from country roles and regional roles that were spanning from managing technical data from the aerospace sector to ethics and compliance regionally for the entire corporation. So United Technologies today is called Raytheon Technologies, and they still have their aerospace and defense sector, but I believe they may have spun off Otis, which was the elevator business, and Carrier, which was the building and industrial system side of the business. So my career was really flourishing. I was enjoying the time with Raytheon, and my career with Raytheon led me from China to Singapore, where I worked much more regionally. And once I had been in that role for about 7 or 8 years and wanted to take on something else, which led me ultimately to Marriott, and totally different industry. Totally different rules of the game, going from aerospace and defense to hospitality. It could not have been more different. Working in aerospace and defense in-house, it's a very, I guess I would just call it cutthroat. People are strict about time. People don't mince words. People are very direct with agendas and what they need to be done and timelines. You don't really get any leniency in terms of work. Going from that environment to Marriott International, which is hospitality, where everyone tries to be happy, tries to be nice to each other, it was really a shock for me. And I remember when I first started at Marriott, and I was based in Shanghai at the time, and I had just started, maybe I had been in the role for a month. I had been sending out emails about things to get done because I was heading up the legal and compliance team for Asia Pacific. And I remember my boss, who was chief legal counsel based in Hong Kong at the time, she emailed me and she said, Jamelia, I'm going to need you to tone your emails down. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What did I do? And she said, we usually start off our emails by saying things like greetings from Shanghai or hello from Bali or how's the weather? She's like, you don't do any of those things. You just get right to it. And I'm like, that's just my training. That's my background. So it was really an adjustment for me to not ruffle feathers of people who were in the hospitality sector. And I learned to actually like it more. I liked being more personable, and I liked working in that way much better than working at Raytheon. And of course, at Marriott, there were a lot of data and privacy issues that I dealt with. I'm sure many of you, if you are Marriott Bonvoy cardholders or membership holders, you may recall the huge data leak for passport information that occurred a few years back. I was involved in the damage control of that. And from a privacy perspective, that was like my worst nightmare. Heading up legal compliance for Asia Pacific at that time, when millions of people's passport information had been leaked, having to deal with the regulators of 15 different countries, investigations, responding, coordinating with the headquarters back in Bethesda, Maryland. it was a nightmare. And from that, I realized that knowing the laws about data privacy and data and technology is very different from executing it. It is totally different. I cannot emphasize that enough. Being able to put processes and software and hardwares in place that actually allow a business to comply with regulations is very different than someone handing you a memo and saying, these are the regulations, please do it. So that was my first, wasn't my first regulatory investigation that I had been involved in, but it was my first global millions, hundreds of millions of people impacted sort of event that I directly had to do damage control on. And it was tough. Loved Marriott, but unfortunately when COVID hit, business slowed down and I decided that maybe it was time for me to move on. Maybe it was time for me to take this knowledge and go somewhere else, do something in another industry. I ended up picking up a role at Standard Chartered Bank, heading up their data privacy operations team globally. And that was a digital transformation program. I guess the best thing I can say about that, shout out to everyone from Standard Chartered who's listening right now, is that it was just a very ambitious program. It still is. It's just a very ambitious program. And unfortunately, when you're an organization that is as large and as culturally old as Standard Chartered, it's very difficult to get digital things through. It's not like you're a young startup and the people that are coming in are used to data and technology and are really able to use tools and are excited and passionate about getting things done. It's actually the opposite of everything I just said. It wasn't really my cup of tea. But what I did learn in that experience is that there's so many emerging technologies that are out there that large institutions, huge Fortune 50, Fortune 100 companies cannot use. And the reason that they cannot use it is not because they don't need it. It's not because they don't want it or their customers don't want it. It's because they're not agile enough. They're not able to make decisions fast enough. They have funding, they have resources, but they're just not able to make decisions quickly enough. And so what did that mean for me as a tech and data attorney who had a global role and very thriving career at the time? It meant that if I really wanted to roll up my sleeves and to understand what's happening in the tech space in a way where I can control what projects I work on, the direction of certain companies in terms of being their trusted advisor, is that I had to go and start a company of my own to be able to do that. There's no other way. And so I left Standard Chartered in 2021. I started up, ByteBow was up and running in August 2021. So it's been almost a good year now. And for those of you that are wondering how the heck I came up with the word ByteBow, byte as refers to a unit of data, but the word bao is Chinese word. It comes from the Chinese word bao hu, which means to protect. So I took that and I meshed it together with ByteBow, and then you have the protection of data. So when I originally started ByteBow, I thought that I was just going to be doing data privacy work. I thought, okay, a lot of emerging technologies, we've got some pretty strong regulations around the world. I had experience with GDPR. I've had experience with China's cross-border data policies. Singapore's was pretty strong. As regional head of legal and compliance teams, I had basically worked in and touched upon the majority of data privacy regulations around the world. So I felt pretty comfortable in doing that, at least to a consultancy perspective. But the clients that were coming to me were not necessarily tech clients looking to manage their data in that way. The clients that were coming to me were clients that were smaller solopreneurs wanting to start a Web3 project. And because it was data, and they are also, most for the most part, were pretty green in running a business, they had a whole host of questions about data and technology and business. And these clients were NFT projects. They were crypto platforms or someone that wanted to launch a coin or a token. And then more recently, in the first quarter of 2022, there were a lot of DAOs. DAOs stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organizations. And so when I saw that trend, I said, huh, Web3 is an emerging technology for sure. I had some exposure to blockchain technology several years previously when I had thought about launching my own startup using blockchain technology for international trade transactions for chemicals. And I just, due to personal circumstance in my life, I just decided to continue with my day job and not pursue that startup at the time. So I knew that the technology was there, and I knew that the technology was valid and quite useful. So I just leaned into it. I leaned into this whole idea of taking everything that I have learned across the aerospace and defense sector, the hospitality sector, the financial services and banking sectors, data privacy, cybersecurity, corporate law, cross-border data flows, cross-border business transactions, and I created ByteBow. And I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to build this up. We're going to get a crap load of attorneys in, and we're just going to go with this, and we're going to create a small army of attorneys for Web3. And that was really the idea of ByteBow, which is to promote and protect Web3 technology through legal compliance. That's it, plain and simple. And it's been an amazing ride. But I realized three things from all of this. The first thing that I realized through the creation of ByteBow is that my skill set and my background and experience with data technology, corporate law, and international business is not the same as every other attorney's experience. And I know that sounds funny. It sounds very obvious. Of course, Jamelia, every lawyer has their own practice and expertise. But I don't think I really appreciated it until I stepped out of the role of being an in-house counsel or heading up in-house compliance teams. I realized that there's somewhat of a learning curve to become comfortable with cross-border transactions and to become comfortable with operating in this gray area of the spectrum of risk as you advise clients. The second piece I realized is that the way that attorneys practice law at law firms is very different from the role of in-house counsel. And then once again, yes, I know it sounds stupid and obvious, but it's very different when you experience it in the work that you do. I've worked with clients before, and I should start to say that when you work in a law firm, a scope of work is created that the client basically says, I need you to do this particular book of work. And it's outlined, it's detailed, it's very clear. Usually it will come up in the format of a memo and some verbal advice, and the memo is usually drafted by associates, backed by legal research, and that stops there. It's, this is the scope of work, this is what you need, here it is, we'll tell you how you should do it, and please go do it. When you're in-house, you really don't get the luxury of distancing yourself from clients because your client is all around you. When I worked at Marriott, I can't think of one person that actually wasn't my client in that company because there were people from sales that had questions, people from business development, people from marketing, the general managers from hotels all around Asia Pacific. There's like 1,000 Marriott properties in Asia Pacific. And you're just talking about GMs, general managers from that standpoint. So there really is no way to distance yourself from your work and say, oh, I drafted the memo for you. Here you go. That's it. No, people will constantly come back. They'll have questions. There will be follow-up. You need to guide them on the practical how-tos. You can't just say the law says X. You need to say, and this is how you do X. And by the way, here's a little booklet about doing X. Hey, and if you don't want to read the booklet, here's a little short snippet training video for you and your team about X. You really need to continually give that hands-on guidance. And so that's the way I work at ByteBow. That's what I do with my clients that are Web3 clients. But what I've heard from them is that most attorneys really are not like that. They're like, thank you for returning my call. Thank you for responding to an email. Last attorney I had ghosted us. I had one client tell me that his attorney ghosted them. I don't know how you ghost a client, but that's some pretty funny stuff to me. So that's the second point, is that what I've learned here is that Web3 clients, they need a lot more hand-holding. They should have more hand-holding because, quite frankly, the environment that they're operating in is very challenging. It's very difficult. The third piece that I've realized in this journey from in-house counsel to Web3 degen is that it's scary. I'm not going to lie. I think one of the scariest parts is that everything is much more public. So I'll give you an example of that. Most of Web3 entrepreneurs or people who are involved in this space, whether it's crypto or NFT or DAOs, they're on Twitter. Twitter is very public. Anything that happens in the space, whether it's a rug pull or someone has scammed someone or SEC or DOJ comes out with new guidance, it's all on Twitter. Usually there's conversation around it. I will be having more conversation around some of the recent statements and enforcements that have been going on. But when you're in-house, nothing is public because everything is protected, right? The company doesn't want you to talk and you obviously won't talk because there's nothing to say. But when you're in the space of Web3, which is very decentralized and very transparent, everyone talks about everything. And I've had clients that I have supported go through really tough times and there's really nothing I could do because their issues or challenges were all public online. So I think that's the thing about Web3 that I think is also very different when you're coming from in-house to operating in the space is that you should really anticipate whatever you do to be very public. Your reputation is your greatest asset. People will talk about the work that you do, whether they liked it or not, whether they liked working with you personally. It's all very public. Those are my three takeaways. Number one, your practice area is very important. And if you can pick up some additional skill sets, practices that are more relevant to Web3, for attorneys that are listening, I think that's a great thing to do. Secondly, having additional exposure to things international and additional exposure to what it means to work as an attorney that works closely with clients and provides a bit more than a memo, but is really more hands-on. If you can work on practicing that, that's a great value add. And then third, get ready for whatever you do to be public, because things are public in Web3. Things are transparent, and you really have to protect your reputation. You got to deliver that quality work. So that has really been my journey from in-house counsel to Web3. And I encourage any attorney who has an existing practice, even those who are just starting out, to really lean in to learning about Web3 technology. Learn about the business models that companies are setting up, how they work, how they operate, how they're going to monetize, what are the issues in terms of regulations. There's so much to learn. Someone asked me in our boot camp, because we also have a Web3 boot camp for lawyers. One of the attorneys asked me, she said, Jamelia, do you think that I need to niche down more? Should I just focus on NFTs, or should I just focus on crypto, or should I just focus on DAOs? Because there's so much going on out there that I really can't become an expert in any one thing. And my response to her was that it's impossible really to separate all three. At this stage, I think it's very difficult to separate knowledge of NFTs away from knowledge from DAOs and knowledge from a crypto. You can't, if a client comes in and says, yeah, I want to create a DAO and we're going to have an NFT component and a cryptocurrency component. So I wanted to know if you could advise on the various aspects of that. Are you just going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I only work with DAO governance, so you'll have to find someone else for crypto and NFTs? No, it's not practical. So my advice is really to learn up as much as you can across all three areas and keep reading the news, keep commenting, keep trying to provide value, keep showing up, and of course, keep listening to this podcast, because otherwise, what the hell am I doing this for? But that would be my advice. And all in all, it's been a really exciting journey from this protected in-house counsel role in an ivory tower, protected away from the Web3 degens, to this wild and crazy world of Web3 where everything is fast and furious and you really have to move quickly. It's exciting. It's interesting. There are regulatory frameworks that need to be set up, but the technology is not leaving. The technology will be there always. As always, I thank you for tuning in to Barely Legal in Web3. Please check us out on Twitter. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Jamelia Greer, or you can follow ByteBao, which is BYTEBAO official on Twitter. You can find us on YouTube. All of our episodes we placed on YouTube as well. I really appreciate you guys checking us out. Would love to hear from you. Would love for you to give us some ideas about what episodes you'd like to hear. Until then, stay safe out there in those crypto streets. Take care.